Last time we met, I got off on talking about spiritual teacher, and I told my same old stories over and over again that some of you have heard far too frequently. And I didn't really treat it very seriously, and when I got home, I got to thinking about it and realized that I really should say something more organized and more serious about spiritual teachers in the Tibetan tradition. Because some of us will go to Yakima and see Tsachoji when he's there. And different people develop different kinds of relations with Rinpoche. And I wanted to speak about that in a more systematic way, but to do it in relationship to some passages in the book we've been reading for the Monday book group on how to practice. And also, Sharon stimulated me with some implicit questions she had about the next part of this. And I saw the whole thing sort of falling together in one piece. And so I wanted to speak about it a little bit. And I'll try to not take too much time. But I prepared some notes. And the place to start is in this book on page 27. His Holiness identifies three different types of morality. He talks about essentially individual vehicle, the collective or community vehicle. He calls it the morality of concern for others, the morality of bodhisattvas, and then the morality of tantra. This is a traditional threefold division in Buddhism. The understanding that some people are engaged in meditation or other kinds of spiritual practice for their own benefit. They recognize their own difficulties, their own sufferings, their own problems, and they're trying to find antidotes for those. And that's their main concern. I have a problem, I want to resolve it. But there's a second level of Buddhist practice, which is community practice, or recognition that we're all in this whole thing together. And that a lot of the issues that we as individuals feel are my problem, actually, when you look at them really closely, turn out to be relational problems, community problems, collective problems. Sometimes I say that a lot of times the things that I'm concerned with in myself, what I find is I hear my parents' voice saying things that I think are untrue or that are problematic. And what that speaks to already is a relationship. It speaks to, this is not just me that has an issue, but there's a family issue that's going on here. And if I'm honest about it, then I recognize that everybody in my family was connected with a larger family, that if my father had some problems, that I somehow got connected with. That's because he had problems with his father, who probably had problems with his father or grandfather or cousin or uncle. And you know, see what I'm saying? We see that everything is connected to a larger whole. The third level, though, which His Holiness speaks about, is the morality of Tantra. And he talks toward the end of the book about Tantra in more detail. But here he says the morality of Tantra, or the practice of the Tantric vehicle, centers around special techniques for imagining a fully developed state of body and mind effectively helping others. Fully developed, like a perfected me. It provides a way to restrain and thus transcend our limited perception of our bodies and minds so that we may perceive ourselves shining with wisdom and compassion. So this Om Mani Padme Hum meditation that we've been doing, this is tantric meditation. This idea of the light shining out from ourselves into the space of this group, this community, this world, this planet, that's shining with wisdom and compassion. Mani Padme, Mani Padme, Mani compassion, Padme, wisdom. So it's a little hint of the tantric path. And we can experience some of this when we chant together the Om Mani Padme Hum. We feel ourselves resonating with that energy together, and we feel something expanding together. But the basis for this is in something very specific. The basis of mind is something very specific. When Buddhists talk about mind or consciousness, and sometimes those terms are used interchangeably, they're talking about a phenomenon that we tend to experience only coarsely. We tend to experience our awareness in relationship to the physical space around us through our senses. You know, our awareness is kind of constrained by what we see, what we hear, maybe by what we think. But already, when we talk about what we think, then we're not really constrained by the here and now anymore. When we talk about what we think, we're constrained by our experience in a certain way. But it's not necessarily experience of here and now. And in that sense, that mental awareness, rather than sensory awareness, can be called subtler. And Buddhists talk about it as being subtler, because it's not limited by the coarse physicality of eye experience, ear experience. Mind experience can range throughout past, present, and future. I can think right now about what's going on in London. And in a certain way, I'm in London, even though my body is here. And if I've been to London and I have a memory of London, then I'm reaching into the past for something that happened. And I'm there in ways that are kind of real. So it's subtler. But Buddhist meditators found that the mind has many more subtle levels than that, that there's subtler and subtler and subtler levels. When we do the mindfulness meditation, which is the alternative meditation that we do, Rinpoche talks about that actually. At a certain point, he talks about the consciousness that observes the mind. So what is it that observes the mind? It's hard to put your finger on what it is that's observing the mind, and yet we can experience it. It's harder to talk about because somehow words can't capture it. So it's subtler than the language using mind. The meditators have found many levels of mind, sort of like the mind or consciousness is like an onion. You keep peeling off layers and you find that there's something that was looking at that layer. And then you observe that and you can peel it away and you find that something was looking at it. And you go farther down and down and down until you reach something that's the subtlest level of mind, that you can't go any farther. You can't go any farther than the subtlest level of mind. That's sometimes called the clear light mind. It's called the clear light mind because you can't predicate much about it, except that it's clear and it's aware. And that's kind of all you can say about it because it's so far beyond language. But one of the things that the meditators have identified, and then this gets at what was on your mind, one of the things the meditators have identified is that that level of mind, although it's constantly changing, is constantly transforming moment by moment, it has a continuity. Because it transforms moment by moment and it changes moment by moment, it's said to have a continuity and never to be the same from moment to moment. But in another way, because of its continuity, never to actually be different from moment to moment. It's kind of paradoxical that it can be the same and different at the same time. But if you think about the notion of same and different, you recognize that that's a coarse mental idea, that things either have to be the same or they have to be different. It excludes other possibilities. Physicists are, these days, working with those other possibilities a lot in illogical, irrational appearing ways. They're finding things like light is both a wave and a corpuscle. It's impossible to be both, and yet appears to be both, depending upon how you look at it. So there are many paradoxes in reality when we get beyond the limits of our own mind. This clear light mind, which is discussed on pages 52 and 54 in the book, so you can look those things up, This is the basis of tantric practice. When Rinpoche has us meditating Om Mani Padme Hum, we're chanting Om Mani Padme Hum, right? This is a way of scraping the surface of that clear light mind, getting at that subtlest thing, which is the essence of me. It's the essence of me which is deeper than my sense of I. The sense of I is coarse. I can be in a situation where I experience I. I'm aware I. I can be self-conscious about I. Traditionally, Tibetans will say, if you really want to understand the I, think of a situation in which you've been falsely accused of something that you didn't do. Okay? I didn't tell a lie. How can you accuse me of telling a lie? The I that comes up in that moment, you're aware of it. Some part of you is aware of the I. Some part of you then is subtler, is the subject to the I, which is then object. Subtler, 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 subject of subject of subject of subject of subject. And this ever-recursive process until you get to the sky-like mind that Rinpoche sometimes talks about. That's also the clear light mind. It's the subtlest thing, constantly changing, constantly there. And in the Buddhist point of view, because it's constantly changing moment by moment, it never ends. It has a continuity which has no beginning and no end, because it's impermanent. Now, there's something illogical here, and I'm not going to go into great detail about it, but the illogic, which is a deeper logic, is that if something is constantly changing and has a continuity, then it doesn't necessarily have a beginning or an end. If there was something in you that Buddhists would call a soul or an essence of what you are, that's what it is. And from the tantric point of view, on the tantric path, this third level of practice, they say that's what goes from life to life. If you don't want to believe in reincarnation, but you like the idea of going to heaven, that's the part of you that goes to heaven, okay, from the Buddhist point of view. Because there are a lot of places where that can get reborn. It does get reborn. It wants a body. Again, I won't go into that in great detail. But it's the basis of all practice. Now, at one point I asked one of my teachers, Tara Tulku, when I was on retreat with him, I said, well, if everybody has this clear light mind, is it the same for everybody or is it different for everybody? Because, you know, there are a lot of mystical traditions that say, in essence, we're all the same person. The essence of me, the essence of Nance is the same. At root, there's no difference between us. The Buddhist view is a little bit more complicated than that. The Buddhist view is that the clear light mind of Nance and the clear light mind of David are two different continuities, that they're independent. Well, they can connect, but I mean, they have their own continuity, so they're separate from each other. But the Tibetans often say, but they have the same taste. If you have a gold ring on and I have a gold ring on, your gold ring and my gold ring are different, but in that they're both gold, they're the same, and their goldness is the same taste. So I asked Tara Tulku about this. I said, so which is the real real? Is the real real that we're separate from each other, or is the real real that we're really all the same? And he said, well, Buddhists have two views on this. And one view is that we're really all the same, and the other view is that we're really all separate. So, I mean, that's a little irritating in one way, but it's remarkably open-minded in another way, because it speaks to an open-minded uncertainty about ultimates. Like, you'll find out for yourself when you get there, but until you get there, this is sort of the view on the issue. A number of years later, I was taking some teachings from Lhotso Rinpoche. So these are my two major teachers. And we were practicing what's called deity yoga in this book, which is you arise in the form of a Buddha and you cultivate that quality of yourself. So you arise in the form of Manjushri and you cultivate yourself as your wisdom, or you rise in the form of Green Tara and you cultivate as yourself that compassionate quality that you have. And it's a way of generating the mind which already is compassionate or already is wise by assuming this form. Again, I won't go into a lot of detail about this. The book talks about it quite well. I said, well, okay, Rinpoche, Lhotse Rinpoche, so if that's the case, are we the same Manjushri or are we two different Manjushris? It's another version of the same question I asked Haratoku to see, well, what answer would he give me?
Similar.
He said, well, if you practice Manjushri and I practice Manjushri and I get enlightened in the form of Manjushri and you get enlightened in the form of Manjushri, then we're two different Manjushris. Except there's one taste of Manjushri, and that way we're the same Manjushri.
So this is similar.
The same answer that Taratoku gave me. Now, the thing about those answers is that one of the ways of thinking about that is that if the essence of me is my clear light mind and the essence of you is your clear light mind, that when I reach that place where I can touch that in myself, in some way I'm also touching you. Yet I'm different, and yet I'm touching you in the way in which there's the one taste and the way in which we're the same. So this is the basis for much Tibetan practice, because the idea is the Lama or the teacher has the same clear light mind as you in the sense of it being the same taste, but it's much more highly cultivated. His mind is, or her mind, because there are female Lamas, much more highly cultivated than yours. So if you can reach deeply enough into yourself where you find the place where you have the same taste as the Lama, then you've connected with the Lama. And that's a very interesting basis of practice, because it's a place which is beyond time and space. It's beyond the usual limitations of I'm in this room now and Zaichoje is over in South India, so he's there and I'm here, we're not connected with each other. But if the mind of he and the mind of me are of the same taste, if I can reach into that place in me, I'll meet him. It doesn't matter where he is. Not only that, it doesn't matter when he is, because there's a lot of very sophisticated Buddhist philosophy about time and about what is and is not real about time. Because much of what we understand about time and the notion of a past and a future, which is not now, is dependent upon our ideas. And our ideas can be very wrong about what's really going on. So it's not necessarily the case that the past exists or doesn't exist. We're not sure about it, but there may be some way in which some elements of the past continue to exist, even though it's past. So when I practice, when I think about my teachers, I think about my teachers reaching into a space which was beyond time in their meditation practice. So if I can reach into that space which is beyond time in my own meditation practice, who am I going to meet? That mind which is of one taste, which is my teacher. That's the basis of practice. Now, there's a place where the Dalai Lama speaks about initiation on page 189. He talks about the importance of initiation in tantric practice. So the reason initiation is important is initiation is a moment when you and the teacher are in the same time and the same space, and the teacher shows you the mind beyond time and space. So it's a moment where you connect with the teacher in that way. And with the practice that he gives you, you can always reach into that space. So this is, from my way of understanding, this is the esoteric importance of initiation. It's a moment when you and the teacher step beyond time and space in a funny way, and that moment is always there, and therefore you're always connected to the teacher beyond time and space through that moment. And you can practice on that basis, because what is it that you encounter in that moment? The clear light mind of the teacher, the subtlest mind of the teacher. That's what's doing the initiation. It's not the physical form of Zachoji, it's the essence of him, which is the clear light mind. On page 172 in the book, again, His Holiness talks about the clear light mind, and the clear light mind is the ultimate teacher. It's the real teacher. It's not the physical appearance of the Lama or the personality of the Lama, but it's the realization the Lama has, which comes through his personality. That's what we're connecting with. If you go to a teaching that the Dalai Lama does, Dalai Lama is kind of a funny old man. But when he turns it on, when he turns on that thing in him that teaches, and the audience is sitting there kind of like, whoa, you know, beyond the, yeah, that was a cute thing to say, into the presence of this person, which is so extraordinary, that's what's there. It's that quality. And that quality is what we're seeking in ourselves, too. And so the teacher models that. Teacher models that. And that's another reason why the teacher is so important. On page 187, finally, His Holiness talks about how to link together calm abiding, the analytic analysis of emptiness, and the practice of deity yoga. I've talked a lot over the years intellectually about the meaning of emptiness. And sometimes we've done meditation practice together, like Tara, mm-hmm. green Tara practice. And we've talked about doing calm abiding when we do the mindfulness meditation. So the essence of the practice that is the visualization practice, of which Om Mani Padme Hum is the auditory version of the visualization practice. The essence of that is to imagine yourself as the perfect Buddha you want to be. Wisdom, compassion, power, kicking the shit out of bad guys. I mean, whatever the Buddha is that you want to be, because there's every kind of Buddha imaginable. You visualize yourself as that. You understand that that, in essence, is emptiness by the technical definition of emptiness, which is it doesn't have an essence. It has an appearance, but it doesn't have an essence because it's constantly changing. So this gets complicated to deal with, but there it is. It doesn't have an essence, and you fix your mind on it. That's calm abiding. You just hold your mind on the image of yourself as that Buddha, and that's the essence of the meditation practice. And then you become that. I used to ride on airplanes. You know, they have the seat pockets in the back of the airplane. Used to be that there was, on every airplane magazine, at the back of the magazine, there was an ad for something called Cyber Vision. And it was how to perfect your golf game. Because who was riding on the airplane? Golfers, businessmen, right? How do you perfect your golf game? The way they taught this was they had you watching videos of great golfers, and then they showed you how to mimic what the great golfer did. If you could swing like Jack Nicklaus or Arnold Palmer, then you can hit the ball like him. And this is how you do it. You practice it over and over and over again. What is that? That's calm abiding on the movement of the body with that swing, replicating the image of the swing of Arnold Palmer. Buddhist meditation, cyber vision, great golf, same thing. Because we're all the same human beings. We learn things in the same way. Okay, so that's the essence of practice. So if you receive an initiation, then you go to the place in that moment where your minds link up, and the image of that initiation and that experience in that time is something you can go back to over and over and over again and experience that quality of that Lama in the form of that Buddha. It's also like how do you make yogurt without yogurt starter? You got to have the yogurt starter to make the yogurt. The initiation is like the yogurt starter. So I mention all this because I have no idea what Rinpoche is going to do in Yakima. Sometimes he gives teachings and initiations on specific practices, other times not. The last time we were all there together, he was teaching about Prajnaparamita, and a lot of people picked up the Prajnaparamita mantra as something that was very calming and very pleasant. That was actually an initiation. He transmitted that sound and the quality of that sound. And truly, every time we sit here and we listen to Rinpoche chanting Om Mani Padme Hum, even though it's on a CD, it's replicating the sound of him chanting. Like that hum sound that he makes at the end. Unbelievable. How does he do that? I can't do that. It has a resonance that's extraordinary, and it always comes into the room with us whenever he does that. So I don't know what he'll do in Yakima. I don't know if he'll be in Yakima. But these are some things to think about if you want to make a connection with him. If he offers the possibility of making a connection, I don't know. If not in December, sometime off in the future, again, if it's something that you want to do. So I gave you the page references here so you can go back to the How to Practice book and you can look at what His Holiness says about these specific ideas, because this book is remarkably clear. I really appreciate that you started reading it and you told us about it, Sharon, because it's just fantastic. Jeffrey Hopkins is a great translator. He used to be the personal translator for the Dalai Lama when he traveled in the United States. Later, Thubten Jinpa took over for all kinds of reasons. Maybe for some reason simply that His Holiness felt he wanted a Tibetan translating for him. Jeffrey has his own way of translating. This is a tour de force. This is the best translation I've ever read of his. And he's a brilliant scholar. So those are the references for you, and you can work on those things. And we can talk about some of these ideas in the future if you want. But I wanted to try and bring it together now so we could have some time to think about these things before December.
Thank you. You know, it's really weird. When you were talking about this layers, I remembered when I was about 9 or 10, I was in the laundry room of our family's home and looking at a picture of a Tide box with a lady holding a Tide box, with a lady holding a Tide box. And I looked at that and I thought, and I got very frightened, because at that point I understood about eternity, that there was no end. There was no end. And you know, when you're 9 and 10, that's big, you know. Just remember, I still get the same kind of wondrous feeling about it, because it was like, everything else has been pretty concrete when you're 9 and 10.
Yeah.
But that was a big one.
Beyond
a big thought.